Hello, I'm Mark Radcliffe, and this is Hope I Die Before I Get Old. When I was a kid, I used to think my grandma was the wisest woman in the world. For every eventuality, she had a little gobbet of homespun philosophy to trot out, and one of the most repeated was, "Mustn't speak ill of the dead." Perplexingly, this phrase would often be preceded by other phrases which would seem to contradict her own advice. For example, "Ooh, your Uncle Terry was a right skinflint womanising old drunkard. Still, mustn't speak ill of the dead." As I grew up, I realised that my gran wasn't as wise as I thought she was. Another favourite expression of hers was, "You can't teach your granny to suck eggs." I've lived 41 years now, and at no time have I felt compelled to test the validity of this statement by inserting a large free range into the dentureless mouth of a passing pensioner. Perhaps then, you can speak ill of the dead in certain circumstances. Or am I just seeking justification for this series, where doing just that has taken up a good proportion of each programme? The question, though, needs to be answered. Are deceased pop stars afforded limitless respect because of their talent, or because they're dead? Tragic martyrs to the cause of rock and roll. Into the crematorium of rock we go then, and on the conveyor belt tonight, Buddy Holly.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, you give me all your loving and your dirt and loving, all your hugs and kisses and money too. Well, you know you love me, baby. Still, you tell me maybe that someday will I'll be you. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. You know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, when Cupid shot his dart, he shot it at your heart. So if we ever part, then I leave you. You sit and hold me and you tell me boldly that someday, well, I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry.
Buddy Holly was born in Lubbock, Texas in September 1936. The first music he was exposed to was country and western, and he was much influenced by Hank Williams, the man who may very well have been the first ever rock and roll star, if only he'd had the sense to hire a drummer and stick a backbeat in there. In the interest of fair play, I'd probably better come clean here and admit that I am a drummer, and therefore subscribe to the view that you can't make great rock and roll without a great drummer. There are others who take the view that drummers should be not seen and barely heard, but this is not to be taken too seriously, as it's a theory usually expounded by bass players. Buddy Holly appreciated the musicality of Hank Williams, but knew he had to harness the rhythmic excitement of Elvis to really kick some ass, though why the early American rockabilly pioneers were so keen to boot people's bottoms, I really couldn't say. Holly's classic recordings were made at a small studio in New Mexico, run by Norman Petty, who later became his manager. Between them, they formulated many revolutionary procedures which shaped the way musicians work in the studio to this day. Double-tracking vocals, overdubbing, experimenting with ambient microphones, playing pool for hours on end. So did this pop sensibility, combined with recording innovation, produce records of true genius? The case for is put tonight by legendary Shadows guitarist Hank Marvin. The case against, by DJ Bob Harris.
He was exceptionally good, had a fantastic skill for writing two and a half minute singles, and was as such a huge influence on a lot of people who followed. Paul McCartney has always said that the specific influence of Buddy Holly, you know, on them, was the fact that when you listen to Buddy Holly singles, everyone sounded slightly different. This one would have a guitar solo, whereas the next one would have a piano solo, or one would have a regular drum kit, the next, you know, like Not Fade Away was a cardboard box, wasn't it? And every day was... Every day it's again... And it literally was thigh-slapping, that sound. So, I mean, they were experimenting, Buddy and the Crickets, and coming up with different things track by track.
Of course, one of the interesting things about the production and the music of Buddy and the Crickets for us as youngsters was the way that they seemed to ring the changes on each single. Fabulous ideas and recorded very well in such a way that when we listened to the records, we weren't quite sure what they were using to achieve some of those sounds. They were looking for something new. They weren't content just to say, hey, this is a sound we've achieved, which is good. Let's work this to death. No, they wanted to look for something new. And that's something which has clearly influenced other people. The Beatles, I understand, certainly it influenced us as the Shads, and I guess many others too.
So his influence is very marked, I think. But as we come towards the end of the 50s and the original sort of flame of rock and roll, the Devil's music and all this, is beginning to die down, rock and roll as such, by 1959, with a few rare examples, had been softened up to such an extent. And it was disappointing to see Buddy Holly appearing to head in that direction. I mean, it doesn't matter anymore. Moon Dreams and those with the big strings and the lush orchestras and all of that.
And it was a very interesting approach. And I don't know whose idea it was to use the strings, whether it was the producer's idea or not. I don't really know. But it was very interesting and very innovative at the time. If Buddy had carried on that way, or had been able to, given the circumstances, then perhaps he would have had a string of hits in that vein.
And if that was the way he was heading, 2 years later he'd been in Vegas. And 2 years after that, with the arrival of the Beatles, he'd be chicken in a basket somewhere. And one's not completely confident that he wouldn't have taken that route.
The sun is out, the sky is blue, there's not a cloud to spoil the view, but it's raining. Raining in my heart. The weatherman says clear today. He doesn't know you've gone away. And it's raining. Raining in my heart. Oh, misery. Of me, I tell my blues they mustn't show, but soon these tears are bound to flow, 'cause it's raining, raining in my heart. It's raining, raining in my heart.
Whether by luck or by judgment, in terms of image, Buddy Holly created one of the design classics of rock and roll. We all know what he looked like, a kind of Sid Little with a quiff, Ian McCaskill after guitar lessons and a crash diet. At a time when Elvis and Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran were perfecting the lip-curling rockabilly renegade pose, Buddy Holly was as clean-cut as they came. He was the perennial preppy college kid, the clean-cut nerd, and Holly-esque geeks have populated pop ever since, from Freddie and the Dreamers, through David Byrne of the Talking Heads, right up to Jarvis Cocker. Anyone remember the Proclaimers? No, me neither. But Buddy Holly practically invented the idea of being uncool in rock and roll. Without Buddy, those of a certain bookish appearance would never have had the guts to get up on stage. And how often have we wished that John Denver hadn't? But oops, sorry, Gran. Mustn't speak ill of the dead.
He was like an early sort of computer geek, is what he looked like, with the glasses and stuff. And it did kind of become cool then to wear glasses.
As a young, spotty 15-year-old, when I first saw a photograph of Buddy Holly and the Crickets, that was a tremendous encouragement, because most of us at that time were, I suppose, exposed to people like Elvis Presley and Gene Vincent and others, and somewhat glamorized photographs, particularly Elvis, something that we couldn't really aspire to. But with Buddy, here was what looked to be, hey, a normal-looking guy wearing glasses, and he can sing and he can play guitar. That was tremendously encouraging, and not just for me, I understand, for people like John Lennon and who knows how many others.
Buddy Holly was never synonymous with raunchy, you know, you'd never find Buddy Holly just filmed by the camera from the waist up. There was no sex appeal to it all. And when you look at the way that Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis were smouldering and Little Richard was being so completely outrageous, and, you know, the visual aspect of rock and roll was part of the appeal and why it exploded at that time the way that it did. And Buddy Holly certainly wasn't sort of a vigorous part of that.
In show business in those days, anyone who did wear glasses used to take them off before they appeared in public. And I remember that the guitarist with Johnny Duncan and the Bluegrass Boys was supporting Cliff and the Shads in 1959. And I, of course, wore my glasses. But Denny Wright, the name of the guitarist, said, it was very nice, really. He took me on one side in a very fatherly way and said, look, Hank, he said, you know, I notice you wear glasses on stage. He said, you shouldn't do that. It's not done in show business. Please take them off. Do yourself a favor. And I said, look, Denny, I said, I can't see. I'm very short-sighted. I'm nearly blind. If I take them off, I'll fall over things, maybe fall off the stage. He said, that doesn't matter. It's the image that counts. And I said, look, Denny, I said, if Buddy Holly can get away with it, I reckon I can. Also, he played a guitar which was something like a spaceship to us at the time, a Fender Stratocaster. It really was quite sensational. And the style of Buddy with his glasses and this guitar seemed something very new, very different. And he could play it, got a great sound out of it.
Heartbeat, why do you miss when my baby kisses me? Does a love kiss stay in my memory? Little pat, I know that new love thrills me. I know that true love will be. Heartbeat, why do you miss when my baby kisses me? My baby's lips meet mine. Heartbeat, why do you flip? Then give me a skip beat sign. Fiddly-pat and sing to me love story.
Buddy Holly left a handful of unforgettable songs. That'll Be the Day, Oh Boy, Peggy Sue, True Love Ways, and, oh, you know, that other great one. The fact that it's only a handful isn't really his fault, considering how short a time he was around. Cliff Richard's also done a handful of unforgettable songs, but the fact that it's only a handful probably is his fault, as he's been around forever. The sad statistic is that Buddy completed just 3 albums before he died, although you'd be forgiven for thinking it was 10 times that number, such has been the endless repackaging and remarketing. Holly's legacy to the music industry, and the masterful company of French butchers, may well be how to flog a dead horse. But it's not just the revamped Greatest Hits albums that have ensured the immortality of those songs. They're also a fixture of any karaoke evening. This is, of course, no guarantee of quality. Whitney Houston's The Greatest Love of All features with equally monotonous regularity. But people, or certainly people who've had a few stiff drinks, love those Holly classics. And crucially, because Holly himself was an ordinary Joe, a rock and roll everyman, they feel able to stand up and belt them out. So is the legacy of Buddy Holly, in a sense, the ethic that eventually led to punk rock? That no matter who you are or what you look like, it's okay to have a go.
I think when you look back at Buddy's music and you think of the effect that had on bands like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones even, and other bands too, who recognize in Buddy that was a big influence on the way they wrote music. And I think really, if you look at the music that happened in the punk period in the 70s, if you look at what's gone through the 80s, the 90s, and listen to some of the pop songs that are happening, particularly the stuff that's using guitars, you can hear very clearly the echoes of the pattern that Buddy Holly set for us.
Yeah, he did influence the Beatles, as described. You know, Paul McCartney took an enormous amount of notice of just this very simple thing of making each record sound slightly different from the other. It sounds so simple and so obvious, but it wasn't. And Buddy did that, and the Beatles followed. And that really was a benchmark for the Beatles. Buddy's influence was huge over Paul's thinking. So, you know, I think through the Beatles, as much as anything else, Buddy Holly's music permeated on.
People are still going back to it. Some of them may not be going back to it consciously, but subconsciously, they're doing it. They've heard it in the music of their heroes that have gone before, and their heroes drew on the influence of Buddy Holly.
I'm gonna tell you how it's gonna be. Are you gonna give your love to me? You know my love will not fade away. Oh well, you know my love will not fade away. My love is bigger than a Cadillac. I try to show it when you're driving me back. Your love for me got to be real. For you to know just how I feel. A love for real not fade away.
Whether Buddy Holly had star quality is difficult to ascertain. The biopics portray a polite, slightly goofy, genuinely nice guy, but rather like, say, Nicholas Witchell, there's no obvious charisma there. His basic musical talent was undeniable, but in terms of presence, well, the best you can say is that he stood out because he was different. He was normal. And in a business where looking abnormal is the norm, his normality was anything but normal. If every American teenage girl, and a good deal of the boys, wanted to run upstairs and jump into bed with Elvis Presley, then they felt they could have relied on that nice Buddy Holly to keep mum and dad chatting in the kitchen about cupcakes and college football until the post-coital Marlborough had been extinguished. This may in fact have been quite unfair to Buddy, who, some say, proves the old adage that the quiet ones are the worst. Salacious stories of his prowess as a lover occasionally leak out, and if eyewitnesses are to be believed, he was anything but underendowed when it came to the equipment. Look, I don't want to get graphic about this, but let's just say that up there in celebrity heaven, when Buddy Holly walks into the showers, Errol Flynn turns to face the wall. So was there, beneath that gawky exterior, the pulsating animal quality of the true star?
It's difficult, I guess, to try to equate someone like Buddy with someone like Elvis Presley. Elvis was a phenomena in a particular way. Whether that image that was there of Buddy was something that he worked on and created, or was just him coming through strongly, this is what I am, what you see is what you get kind of thing, without any overt glamorization. I don't know. But he certainly had some kind of a star quality that people appreciate. You've only got to look at the warmth, the feeling towards Buddy Holly, which is still there. We don't forget him and his music. All of us are still there. We're still hooked. We're still big fans. And I think that is something that is bound up with star quality. He was there. He had an image to us of the guy next door. And I think that's an important part of star quality. Some stars have that image. They're the boy next door, the girl next door, and we can relate to them. We feel close to them. Others are not like that. Some are way beyond that. You know, there's something on another planet, and we can't really get close to them. They're not the boy next door. They're the boy from another planet. I think Buddy had a kind of a star quality, the boy next door.
It seems that Buddy Holly was, as a person, very headstrong, and had a strong personal drive, a sort of ego-driven drive. And that was the main reason for his desire to sort of go solo, to start his own career. But I think that the thinking was that he wanted to become an all-round, you know, entertainer, which was the catchphrase at the time. You used pop music, in inverted commas, as a stepping stone onto becoming, again in inverted commas, an all-round entertainer. And I think that that could well have swallowed Buddy Holly up. And if it had done, the advent of the Beatles and the beat boom explosion from Britain and the Stones and the Pretty Things looking so much rougher and, you know, being so much funkier, I think that could well have seen him off permanently. It did most of them. And I don't think Buddy Holly would have been immune from that.
Buddy Holly died aged just 22 on the 3rd of February 1959. In those days, it didn't matter how big you were or how many records you'd released. To make money, you toured. This meant that itineraries were tight, and it was in a desperate rush to make the next gig that fateful plane was chartered. It came down in Iowa at a place called Clear Lake. It's a pity the skies weren't enjoying the same degree of clarity. The crash also claimed the lives of Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper. Perhaps this was the excess baggage that made the plane unstable. Perhaps if they'd only taken the little bopper, or at most the medium bopper, Buddy would still be with us today. It's sometimes been suggested that with Elvis in the army, Buddy could have become the biggest rock and roll star in the world. Certainly it seemed like the King's throne was vulnerable, and Holly was as well placed as anyone to hoist himself up there. But perversely, did failing to get to baggage reclaim ultimately deliver true immortality?
Buddy insisted on being on the plane. He wouldn't contemplate being on the bus. No, that's for the scruffs. You know, I think that it's another indication that that is the route that he would have taken, away from rock and roll into respectability and four-star hotel cocktail bars.
Well, some think that Buddy's death came at exactly the right time, and perhaps that was it. You know, his career had peaked, and he went out with a bang, so to speak, with a huge hit in It Doesn't Matter Anymore. Others feel that perhaps he was still searching and would have achieved even greater things musically. I think that Buddy was still searching, that he was still trying very hard to create and look at new ways of expressing himself musically.
There were a lot of worries at the time as to whether, you know, the new material would sustain the career. And of course, It Doesn't Matter Anymore was such a sort of poignant release immediately after his death. And there was that groundswell of sympathy, and it was such an awful thing. You know, these three young pop stars had been killed in that way.
I like to think that this man could have gone on to even greater things. We don't know how long it would have lasted. Maybe only another 2, 3, 4 years at the most. Who knows? We simply do not know. But I would like to think that Buddy Holly could have given us something even greater than he did.
You've heard both sides of the argument. You make up your own mind. Buddy Holly, rock and roll original or cabaret act with big glasses, a sort of Rolf Harris without the extra leg. Whichever way you decide, I must say I feel a certain debt of gratitude to Buddy Holly. Not just for the music, but because he refused to accept that you couldn't be a rock and roll star if you didn't look good in leather. And for those of us who don't really look good in anything, this was a truly heroic stance. On the rare occasion I see a photo of myself at some showbiz bash in the company of glamorous celebrities, I'm always conscious of the fact that I look like the coach driver mistakenly caught in the picture. And this, I feel sure, Buddy would have understood. He was what he was and didn't try to hide it. And if he was here today, well, I don't know if the new songs would be any good, but I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have switched to contact lenses. I'm Mark Radcliffe, and Hope I Die Before I Get Old was a Smooth Operations production.
There you go, baby, here am I. Will you left me here so I could sit and cry? Well, golly gee, what have you done to me? Well, I guess it doesn't matter anymore. Do you remember, baby, last September, how you held me tight each and every night? Well, whoops-a-daisy, how you drove me crazy, but I guess it doesn't matter anymore. There's no use in me a-crying. I've done everything and now I'm sick of trying. I've thrown away my nights and wasted all my days over you. Well, you go your way and I'll go mine. Now and forever till the end of time, I'll find somebody new. Baby, we'll say we're through and you won't matter anymore. There's no use in me a crying. I've done everything and now I'm sick of trying. I've thrown away my nights and wasted all my days over you. Well, you go your way and I'll go mine. Now and forever till the end of time, I'll find somebody new. And baby, we'll say we're through and you won't matter anymore. You won't matter anymore.
Greetings, creatures of the night. I'm Mark Radcliffe, and this is Hope I Die Before I Get Old, another alien autopsy in the Roswell of rock and roll. By the very nature of the job, rock stars have a tendency to die young. Well, all right, not all of them, but statistically it's a fact that you're more likely to live fast and die young if you're a rocker than if you're a chartered surveyor. The question here as always, though, is, does early death automatically sanctify the victim, even if their oeuvre little deserved it? As we approach the rock and roll autopsy room, do we come to embalm or dismember? And whose turn is it to mop up? And who's on the slab anyway? Blimey, it's Janis Joplin.
Honey, you know I did. But each time I tell myself that I want to think I've had enough. But when I'm gonna show you, baby, that a woman can't be tough. I want you to come on, come on, come on, come on and take it. Take another little piece of my heart now, baby.
Break it.
Take another little bit of my heart now.
Shine if it makes you feel good.
Janis Joplin, no relation to Scott, that's Scott Joplin, and not Scott out of Thunderbirds, whose surname was Tracy, and who was no relation to anyone because he was a puppet, was born in Port Arthur, Texas in 1941. Much influenced by the legendary Tennessee blues diva Bessie Smith, she made her stage debut in 1961, and soon landed a residency at the Purple Onion Club in Houston. This was, of course, the advent of the psychedelic 60s, a time when unlikely colours being bestowed on innocent vegetables was considered more or less obligatory. Moving to San Francisco, she fronted Big Brother and the Holding Company, with whom she would later enthrall the audience at the Monterey Pop Festival. Well, at least the parts of the audience who were still enthrallable and not out of their heads on LSD. She'd become perhaps the biggest white blues singer there was, and her approach to singing was nothing if not full-on. But was it any good? Was it truly great gravel-throated soul-bearing? Or was it just shouting? Counsel for the defence is DJ and singer, most notably with The Waves, Katrina Leskinich. While counsel for the prosecution is DJ and singer, most notably with No One Notable, Nick Barraclough.
I'm always having a go at sacred cows and getting myself in a lot of trouble. I find a lot of Bob Dylan stuff hard to listen to. I don't get Van Morrison. I don't get Jerry Lee Lewis. And the other thing I never got, of course, was punk. Because punk was terribly important socially, terribly important how it changed the music, terribly important as a fashion trend, terribly, but you don't want to listen to it. And that's the way I feel about Janis Joplin.
I think Janis's music was excellent. I think her music had energy and it was raw, set people free. Her influences were people like Etta James. Etta James was a notorious heroin addict and was living hard. And it's like the drugs went in and all this music and this wildness came out of their mouths.
Me and Bobby McGee, which she absolutely crucified, was done better by many others. And what she did to Irma Franklin's Piece of My Heart was a terrible thing. There was no subtlety about it. There was no nuance. It was all one-dimensional stuff, which was open your mouth, put your head back, and do it as loud as you possibly could. It was not pleasant to listen to.
If you had a rebel heart, then you were bound to be drawn to the stuff because you could live vicariously through the woman. You could sit back and watch her destroy herself and make a mess of her life and appear to be really enjoying it and getting off on it and able to cope with it.
There probably was a voice that could have really done some stuff that would have been great to listen to. But the oral assault that she kept up for those years was just too much for me.
One moment that I always remember is a concert that she was doing. I think it was at the Monterey Pop Festival. And Mama Cass Elliott was sitting back in her seat. And Mama Cass, you have to read her lips because you can hear Janis Joplin in the background, who is up on stage wailing her head off. And you read Mama Cass's lips and she's saying, "Wow." And that was the effect that Janis Joplin had on people.
I've got to say, having said all this stuff, that there is a poignancy in the way she sings, "Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz?" It certainly doesn't sound like she's just reading the lyrics. She wants one. She really does.
I like to do a song of great social and political import. It goes like this. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? Oh Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Dialing for dollars is trying to find me. I wait for delivery each day until 3. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Oh Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? I'm counting on you, Lord. Please don't let me down. Prove that you love me and buy the next round. Oh Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? Everybody, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime, no help from my friends. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz?
Janis Joplin is remembered not only for her voice, but also the way she looked. These were hippie times when washing and ironing and blow drying were considered square. And yet the lasting female images of the time are of willowy hippie chicks with silken waist-length hair in virginal white cheesecloth smocks. The lasting male images are of gnarled greaseball bikers with furry freak barnets in jeans that look like they've been used as a urinal. Let's face the sexist truth. It was a time of letting it all hang out and dressing in whatever rags you felt removed you farthest from bourgeois constraints. But girls were still supposed to look, well, nice, slim, desirable, even clean. It was a time of free love, but most blokes, finding themselves involved in a bit of free love with the mamas and the papas, would have gone for love a good deal freer with Michelle Phillips than they would with Mama Cass. Janis Joplin was having none of it. She was no beauty, and if the boys were going to dress like vagrants, why then, she was going to be the first bag lady of rock. Perhaps in this she was a crucial role model. Perhaps she was one of the very few women in the music business ever to dare to be overweight and underdressed. Did she, in her own way, set female musicians free to be as unattractive as their male counterparts?
I'm not sure Janis Joplin really made the road easier for your Karis Matthews or your Courtney Loves or Madonna, I suppose. I think Janis was just, she had a rebel heart. She was a wild woman. I don't think she paved the way for anyone. I think, if anything, she may have given hope to fat, ugly, pimple-faced women who didn't think they would ever get a guy.
I don't think she was a role model for... Well, she was a role model for women. She was a role model for women who wanted to drink themselves stupid and be off their faces, look horrendous. I mean, she was a role model for complete wrecks who wanted to die very young. She was an appalling role model for anybody who wanted to get anything decent out of life.
I don't think she made it okay, but I think she made it look like it was a tempting thing to try. It was a tempting prospect, but I don't think she made it okay. I think everyone knew that it was dangerous to live the way she was living and to express herself the way she was. I mean, it was a very, very daring thing to get up there and completely bare her soul. And I think lots of people just were in awe of that. I think they were envious of that. Women, I think they were just beginning to feel liberated and to feel like they could speak and they had a voice and it was okay to be wild and party like one of the boys, but they didn't dare do it yet. But Janis was way ahead of the rest of them.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained and rode us all the way into New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues. Windshield wipers slapping time, I was holding Bobby's hand in mine. We sang every song that Javi knew. Another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, I mean nothing, honey, if it ain't free. Nah. And feeling good was easy, love, when he sang the blues. You know, feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby. Next to mine. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing. That's all that Bobby left me. Yeah.
was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby.
Janis Joplin didn't make many records. She didn't have time. She didn't write much either. She didn't have the ability. Or at least, if she did, she wasn't sober enough to realise it. She was also, inevitably, a drug addict. These were the 60s. The pathway to enlightenment could only be trodden by those out of their brains on mind-bending narcotics. Drugs would open the eyes of the beautiful people who would go on to create art that would change the world. Well, that was the idea. In fact, drugs made the beautiful people pretty much incapable of creating anything at all, except damp patches in their trousers after failing to negotiate their flies in the lavatory. Janis was probably no more out of it than most of the people around her, but she was certainly in no fit state to leave a legacy of great songs. But sometimes, just sometimes, you can sing through the drug and alcohol-induced haze and really make the nerve ends tingle. And if Janis leaves any legacy at all, it's in the full frontal, totally uninhibited way she approached the microphone, and indeed the bar.
I think that Janis always felt like she had something inside her that was screaming to get out. She was in constant battle with herself and the demons inside. And I think she found a venue for those demons. She found some place to put them, some place for them to go. And it was into the music, into that microphone, into the audience, into people's consciousness. And I think that that absolutely delighted her.
Well, a legacy, what is a legacy? A legacy is when you get your old records out, when you get your old Beatles records out, which I do, and listen to them and go, yeah, it's still there, isn't it? I even get Steely Dan records out and listen to those and go, yeah. You don't get your Janis Joplin records out anymore. You don't have your friends around and say, oh, let's put some Janis Joplin on. Do you get in your car and put a CD of Janis Joplin on? I don't think so. Nor do you hear on the radio. It just doesn't sound good these days. Not that it sounded that good then.
I think it's one thing to let yourself go and to give yourself to the music and give yourself to rock and roll. And I think it's another thing, getting caught up in drugs that take a hold of you and won't let you go. And I think that got out of control for her in her life. I don't think by the end she had a choice at all in the matter. I think her body was crying out for the drugs, so she took them.
If you want to talk about female singers who left a great legacy, then, you know, Billie Holiday, for goodness sake. Now, she had as difficult a life as Janis Joplin, but my goodness, she could sing. She really articulated. She really, really sang from the soul, not from the throat.
Trust in me, baby. Give me time, give me time. Give me time. I heard somebody say, the older the grain, sweeter the wine, sweeter the wine. Give me time, give me time. Please, a little more time. Takes the road runner just a little bit longer, dear. I wanna make up my mind. I gotta make up my mind. Oh, my love is like a sea, baby. Just needs time. Too much of your loving, baby. Yeah, I don't wanna mess your life around. So if you love me like you tell me that you do, dear, you should mind paying a price, any price, any price. Love is supposed to be the special kind of thing. Make anybody want to sacrifice.
trusted my love in my heart. Keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith in me, dear. In my arms, in my love.
Janis Joplin became a huge star, but did she have what we'd recognise as star quality? When she walked in the room, always assuming she didn't stumble into the table and knock the drinks over, would you have been struck by her easy laugh and effortless charisma? Or would you have been struck by a cheap sherry bottle that fell out of her hand? Watching film of her on stage, it's really the sheer intensity of performance that's compelling. Physically, she's just an old boiler with ungainly legs. Not that that held Tina Turner's career back, but Tina had the glitzy frocks and the smile and the walk and the sassiness. Janis didn't have any of those. She just threw on what looked like ill-fitting clothes run up out of old curtains, much like Julie Andrews did for the Von Trapp kids in The Sound of Music, although why no one informed social services is a mystery to me, and she sang. But no matter how remarkable Janis's vocal performance, does that alone constitute star quality?
I think, in my opinion, Janis Joplin was more sensational. I think we just liked looking at that. She was compulsive viewing because we knew that she was tearing herself up. She was living rough, and every swig of that Southern comfort that she took, we were like, yeah, because we loved it. She was a party animal. She was doing that stuff that we daren't do and getting away with it.
Yeah, I would say that it was important to show, particularly at that time, at the end of the 60s, that you could do it your own way successfully. And if nothing else, she was certainly uncompromising, and that was a great lesson for people who followed her to learn. But the trouble was, she was uncompromising to the point where she killed herself. So, you know, what's the point in that?
She was loose. She was out there. Nobody else was doing it. I mean, she was half man, she was half woman, in my opinion, because she rocked like one of the boys.
But unfortunately, Janis not only rocked like one of the boys, she died like one too. She died of a heroin overdose in her Hollywood hotel room in October 1970. Heroin, hotel, Hollywood. All the ingredients of the classic cliché-ridden rock and roll death, and yet they're only clichés because people like Janis made them so. There's an undeniable glory in checking out that way. No matter how much we might disapprove, and no matter how much we might hope to live to enjoy old age and retirement and all the joys that brings, in particular Crown Green Bowls and Countdown, the way Janis went is way cool. A good career move, then?
It's the ultimate rock and roll sacrifice to die young, to ruin yourself, to sacrifice everything in the pursuit of rock and roll, in pursuit of a party.
It was a brilliant end to the career, though, for her to die young. It really was. As a result of that, it was possible for millions of people to go very dewy-eyed about her and to glorify her in her death. All of a sudden, she was sanctified, and I really think it helped her enormously. To speculate on what would have happened had she lived, there's no point in it, because there was no way she was going to. She was never going to get past that age. But I really, really think that the fans of her who liked the way she presented herself and the way she looked and the drink and the drugs that she did, the people who went for that stuff, then really said, yes, you've come through for us, Janis. You've done what we always needed you to do.
I think we hoped that she would crash at some point, because I don't think there would be anything more pathetic than seeing Janis Joplin limp to the Betty Ford Center and come out all better with a new hairstyle and a slimmed down, all new, squeaky, clean, and girl next door friendly Janis Joplin. But it wasn't going to happen. And it would have been, like I said, our worst nightmare to see her transformed and to see her get better. It ended perfectly for her. It was a storybook ending for her.
It's just a terribly, terribly sad end to a sad life. I believe that we do like our stars, our idols, to die young. It makes us feel better about ourselves. And one thing about Janis Joplin you could always say was that you watch her on stage and you think, actually, I'm really quite healthy. I'm really doing well here. I think there are a lot of people whose careers you could say they would really, really cut short. And if they'd gone on, just think of what they could have gone on to bring to us. But I think she was spent.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you've heard the summings up of our allegedly learned counsel, and now you must retire to play bowls and watch Countdown. Sorry, retire and consider your verdict. Janis Joplin, seminal white blues heroine and martyr, a sort of Joan of Arc without the bonfire, or caterwauling junkie waster with all the style of Vanessa Feltz if she'd let herself go. The choice is yours. I'm Mark Radcliffe, and Hope I Die Before I Get Old was a Smooth Operations production.
In this world, if you bring the papers down, you know everybody's fighting on with each other. You got no one you can count on, baby, not even your own brother. So if someone comes along, he gonna give you some love and affection. Taking a gamble on a little song.